failure in any of those efforts, Nora.
Yeah, that's truly stunning. That was on the path of the
Hello?
Is this DC?
I don't know.
Hi, Mr. Wallace?
Hey, Jeff Hill, how you doing?
Hey, good. Thank you very much for calling me back.
Yeah, I don't remember. Do I know you?
No, you don't know me. I was just, the reason I was calling you is because I was reading some stuff on the internet today about you, about 9/11.
Yeah.
And you were at the Pentagon?
I was.
And I was just wondering, I was reading, it said that you saw the plane coming in?
That's correct.
How high off the ground was it when you saw it?
Well, it was about 200 yards away, Jeff. It was actually right on top of the cars, crossing the freeway. And it's approaching the building about a 45-degree angle or so. And it just came right on across the field and went right through the first floor windows.
So it was, low and level for a while?
Yeah, it appeared to be. That's the way I described it when my first interview was. I said it appeared to be in a level flight, and there was no warning that it was there until we had seen it. No noise. As my partner said the same thing. There was no warning until we see the airplane, and then immediately there was this very, very loud noise. I'm sure it was the engines of the aircraft. And the airplane hits the building. It happened so fast that from the time we saw it until the plane had hit the building, I don't even think we'd started, but we probably hadn't even started running yet. It was just, there it is. You know, you're in the process of turning your back to it and get out of the way. And as it comes toward the building, it's coming closer to us. So one of the measurements was on an FBI drawing. I didn't understand what it was. They estimated, I assume it was from the left front corner of the fire truck where we were standing. We were standing and we had moved out to the front of the fire truck. It's 10 or 15 feet or so.
Yeah, you guys ran and dove behind the fire truck or something?
No. We would have done that. We'd have been done for.
Oh.
We ran to our right. What I was the one that did the diving. I dove forward, and when I did this, I happened to be right beside our transportation, which was a Ford van, which is parked on the west side of the fire station and facing north. And when I did that, I immediately, I didn't do it intentionally, but once I hit the ground, I realized that the van was there, and I crawled into the van immediately. And almost as fast, I crawled out the other end because I thought I was on fire.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, but what I was mentioning a moment ago, the distance was measured, estimated to where the center of where the airplane actually hit the nose of the airplane hit the building was supposed to be, the number was 140 feet. And I would assume, I always tell the story, and I would imagine it was measured from the left front corner of the fire truck at an angle back toward the Pentagon to that estimated point of impact.
Yeah, I see a picture of a red fire truck. It looks like it's kind of smashed up and stuff. The plane hit the fire truck?
A significant part of the plane hit. They told us, another story goes into that one of those FBI drawings, that they told us that the tail of the airplane had told me, I remember, because I was getting ready to do my FBI interview there at Fort Myer,
uh-huh.
Two days later on Thursday. The guy was, they were getting some papers and stuff ready, and the guy says, here's some stuff you can look at. If you have any questions, you know, let us know. If you disagree with anything, let us know. So I was looking at this drawing, and it was just, you know, you're looking down, we'll say you're looking down on top of of that site there, the crash site. You see the fire station, see the fire truck, and there was a measurement there that was 31 and a half or something, 31 and a half inches. And I looked at that, and I'm trying to think, what does that mean? Is that the diameter of the tire, or what does it mean? And I asked the guy, and he goes, I don't know. And the other guy looks at it, and he says, oh, I helped do this. I know what that is. He said, we measured a distance from, there was a concrete runway, that comes out of the fire, comes away from the fire station, and at the end of it, and it's about 50 feet long, I guess, and at the end of it, The concrete is gray or white, and it stops. And beyond that, and to the south, was brand new, black, shiny, pretty blacktop. And also out to the west side of that runway was also blacktop. The measurement apparently was measured from the side of the fire truck back over to this line that was created between the concrete and the blacktop, and that dimension was 31.5 inches or something like that. And I said, and the guy explained to me what it was, and I said, that's, somebody's made a mistake here. When I parked that fire truck, I put both of those tires right on that line. And the one guy says, are you aware of, we think the tail of the airplane hit the fire truck.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that. This is only a couple days later.
Yeah.
So that's where I got that. I remember that very well. To me, the left wing would have been more likely. Something from the left wing would have been more likely to have hit the fire truck. It ends up tearing the left rear wheel off the truck, crushes the engine compartment, almost knocks the generator off the top of the truck, damages the fire station, which is beyond to the north of the fire truck. Damaged the van that I crawled under, damaged the flight control tower, which sat on top of the fire station, and of course set that area of the building on fire as well. That help?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I could see that the back left wheel had gone off that fire truck.
Yeah.
But you were there at 7:30 in the morning?
Yeah, that's the usual time. That's when we should have been there. President Bush was coming back from Florida. He sometimes flies back from Andrews on the helicopter into the White House, sometimes into the west side of the property there by the Washington Monument, depending on what's going on. If there was something going on at the White House where they couldn't land the helicopter there, and apparently there was something going on. I didn't know this until several years later. I read this in somebody's book. What we were responsible for on the morning of the attack was the helicopter returning from Andrews after Air Force One returned from Florida to Andrews. The helicopter would bring the president and whoever was traveling with him back to the Pentagon. The motorcade would meet them there and take them probably back to the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was due in at noon. Our first flight that morning was actually due in at 10 o'clock. The attack occurs about 9:38 or so. So the first flight didn't show. Matter of fact, no helicopters, to my knowledge, landed there. Well, certainly not in the next 6 months, anyway.
Yeah.
No helicopters landed there that day.
And did you ever know a guy named Captain Mike DeFina?
Oh, yeah. Mike's one of the firefighters at the airport. Mike's a good guy.
Yeah, because I had talked to him, and he said that, I was reading something, and then I asked him, he said that it was true that they had knocked down the bulk of the fire in the first 7 minutes that they got there.
That's possible. At that point, I think our people were, myself and the other two fellows that were with me, I would say for, I don't know, maybe 10 minutes, we were up against the building there behind the fire truck, and it was, and just before this, it was brought to my attention, that there were people by another guy who came to our rescue, as I say,
mm-hmm.
That there were people in the building right behind the burning fire truck, and he said to me, which I remember him very well, and I've become friends with him since, I don't remember him saying to me, if you can boost me into this window, we can get these people out of the building, but I definitely remember him being there, and I remember being working with him, and I remember doing that. I just don't remember that he selected me. When I had a chance to talk to him, I said, why did you grab me instead of one of the other guys? And he says, because I didn't think the other two guys could do it. I was boosted him in it. Well, when he's telling this story, was in about April, I'm going to say, of 2002. They had a award ceremony in the courtyard of the Pentagon, and he had and I had lost track of this guy. All I remember about him is what he was wearing, what he looked like, about his age, how old he was, and things like that. Well, he calls me up at the firehouse. I was still working, and he said, I'd like to invite you to the ceremony. And I said, what were you wearing? And he goes through this And I said, well, I know exactly who I'm talking to, because every interview that I had done, I always commented about this guy. I said, this guy needs to be recognized for what he did. I hold him responsible for the rescue of the people in the building directly behind the fire truck. And but when he's telling this story, he tells it to, when he introduces me to his mother and dad and his brother, and I think his sister at that ceremony, each time he says, this is the guy I told you about at Boosting the End of Wind. And I said, are you sure? Yeah, and I said, well, I don't remember that. I don't think it was me. Well, finally, after about the third time, he introduces me to the Air Force Chief of Staff, who was General Jumper. And he said, this is the guy I told you about at Boosting the End of Wind. And about that time, he says, he damn near threw me in the building. No, I think I remember that. Well, I didn't. You know, I just said it to be funny, but obviously he knew what he was talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was kind of a cute story, I thought.
So,
but anyway, that's the way that went. And I wouldn't, and whatever Mike says, I would certainly agree with him. The fire truck continued to burn for a long time, I know that. There wasn't anything that Dennis or Mark and I could do to put the fire out. The fire extinguishers were expelled, one of them, well, actually two of them. I used two of them. One of them seemed like it was partially empty. That was the carbon dioxide bottle. And the Purple K bottle that I carried into the building, I remember I wasn't in the building, I don't think, more than 5 minutes. And I ended up coming back out of there. Probably the only guy on the East Coast stupid enough to take a fire extinguisher in a five-alarm fire.
Did you hear a second explosion after the initial impact?
No. I think I know what you're talking about.
It was after the impact and before the roof collapsed.
No, I do not remember that. For the longest time, Jeff, well, right away when we were being interviewed after we got that, the squad guys got done wrapping us up, Skipper and I, these law enforcement people, I don't know if they were Secret Service or Department of Defense or FBI or who they were, they had badges on their belts. And this one guy said, made the comment, he said, that had to have been a terrific noise. And I just assumed he was referring to the impact of the airplane. And, of course, there was an explosion immediately then.
Yeah.
And my comment to him was, well, no, it wasn't particularly loud. It was just a long crunch. And but if you talk to anybody that else that was anywhere around that area, like down at Crystal City or the vicinity, it was a very loud noise, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But Skipper and I, and for the longest, it was like three or four or five years went by before I realized what was different to Skipper and I, because he was with me, we were outside, as compared to somebody else over in Crystal City. They heard a boom, a big a loud explosion. Skipper and I hear this, the noise of this airplane, and then this crunch. And for the longest time, I kept thinking, it's so strange that the noise of the plane hitting the building didn't seem to be particularly loud. And again, it was very loud. And I often wondered why, you know, and everybody said, oh, hell, it was the adrenaline or something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think what it was is the noise that preceded the impact was this very, very loud noise. I'm sure it was from the engines, and it was just like we were enveloped in it, like it was coming up out of the ground. And so for us, we heard two noises, the noise of the airplanes, I'll say it this way, and then the actual impact of the, I remember thinking, you know, that the planes hit the building, let's see, what am I going to do now? I guess I'll run and I'll catch on fire, and after that I'll figure out something else. And I had very, very clear thoughts. I never thought I was going to die or anything like that. Never occurred to me. Never crossed my mind that we were going to die, any three of us. And for the longest time, it never occurred to me that there were people on the airplane.
Yeah.
I remember saying to Skipper, where the hell are they getting these airplanes from? And Skipper says, they're hijacking them. And I'm thinking, how could they get a gun on an airplane? And I'm thinking, these people that work at the airports, they let them on the gun. They let them on the plane. Well, we know that that's not true. Like I say, it was an odd, had a lot of unusual thoughts, you know, you know, where are they getting the airplanes from, or particularly the fact, like I mentioned just a moment ago, it never occurred to me that there were people on the airplane. So then how'd they get the airplane? What'd they do? They hijacked the thing? That never occurred to me.
Yeah.
Mentioned it. So how'd they get the airplane out of the airport? Did they hotwire the thing and get a bunch of guys to push it away from the gate? How did they get the airplane? You know, at the time, I'm not thinking of something like that.
Like, do you remember when you seen the plane, you could tell it was an American Airlines? Or?
No, I didn't notice that, but I described it. When we were at the hospital, I think it might not have been the first time that I described what the airplane looked like, but I remember when I described it, as I was describing it, Skipper sitting behind me in this Jeep. This is our transportation. This is our vehicle at the hospital that a security lady is driving, and she's going to take us back to Fort Myer. So the news people come over to the vehicle, and the guy starts talking, and then the next thing is they pass a microphone through the driver's window, and the poor lady is leaning back because the microphone pole is right in her face, and the camera guy is standing over on the, I'm sitting in the front seat of the Jeep, and the guy starts asking questions. He said, "What did you see?" And I said, "I saw a white airplane with orange and blue stripes." Well, if you know anything about American, it's not orange and blue, it's red and blue.
Yeah.
And the skipper says, "It wasn't white, it was shiny." And I said, "Okay, it was shiny." And then the guy says, "I don't suppose you know what airlines it was." And I said, "I couldn't tell you." And the skipper said, "It's American." And I remember turning around to him and saying, when I said, "Let's go, how long did you look at the airplane?" And I'm not real sure that's what I said, but that's when I did the interviews, that was the expression that I said, "Let's go."
And you said, yeah, and you said, I had read, you said it was about 25 feet above the ground or something?
Yeah, it was, like I said, it was right on top of the cars.
Yeah, because when you see, like, the animations and stuff on the documentaries, it shows it, like, maybe, like, just skimming right above the grass.
Yeah, there were at least three light poles, Jeff, that were damaged. Two of them I saw personally that had been cut off. One was, the two that were cut off at about 12 feet, they were on the side of the freeway toward or the Pentagon side.
Mm-hmm.
It was the third one that was hit by the airplane and knocked onto the freeway. It was on the other side. It was on the approach side of the freeway, the Washington Boulevard there. And it hit a taxi cab, knocked its windshield out. We've got photographs of that.
Oh, yeah, I'm familiar with that, yeah.
Yeah, guys on the cell phone there. And then later on, I guess people picked that thing up and just dropped it over the guardrail, over onto the grass there.
Do you remember, like, when it came in, do you happen to remember if it was, like, to the left or to the right of that Citgo gas station?
It would have been at that point, it would have been, I'm guessing it almost would have come right down over top of it. Citgo station's there on, that's not Army, maybe that street is Joyce. I don't know what street it is, but it goes south to Army Navy Drive. Anyway, it would be, I'll tell you what, if you've got a map of that area, Jeff, you can take a straight edge.
Yeah.
And you'll see the overpass there, the clover leaves and everything, and it would be to the north of the overpass or underpass. And if you put one end of the straight edge just about to the center of the length of the west wall of the Pentagon, and put the other and put part of the straight edge back to the southeast or southwest or west, and put it just to the north of the overpass, that is the path of the airplane. Because when we saw it, when I first saw it, it was right in front of those big freeway signs there that say Pentagon South Parking. And I remember that information, what I just told you, is easy to recall because when we were working, some guy comes up to me. I suppose he was a law enforcement person. I don't even remember what he looked like or anything about him. He said, "I understand you," something like, "I understand you saw the airplane." Yeah, and he says, I remember we were still doing something. And maybe carrying somebody, I don't know. And the guy says, "Well, where did you see it?" And I said, it came from over there. And it was kind of a general first comment. And then the guy came back later and he says, "Where did you say it came from?" And I said, it came from that direction over there. And then he came back later on and he said, Okay. Okay, bye-bye. And and then he says, he comes back, I think, the second or third time, maybe probably the third time, and he says, "That can't be right." And I said, "It came across the road in front of those big green highway signs." And that's the last time I saw him. Maybe I made him mad or scared him off or something, I don't know. But, and then apparently, oh, I'm sorry. Then he comes back and he says, he came back later, or he came back later and he says, "You must have been right because there's light poles over there knocked down." So at that point I hadn't, I had been out to the guardrail at the freeway because we had taken people out there. And one person, I remember helping three or four other guys carry this guy all the way out to the guardrail. And that was probably the last person I had last victim I had any contact with.
Mm-hmm.
But those poles were 150 yards away from, we were walking perpendicular away from the Pentagon straight out to Washington Boulevard there where the guardrail was, where the med units were, and everybody else was out there assembling, and some of the medical people obviously were in that area as well.
Well, yeah, like I've seen where it showed it hit light poles. I guess they say it hit 5 light poles.
It could have. I just remember that. I know that there were 3 for sure.
But and it's weird because the light poles are like pushed forward, or they're pushed back, where as if it was, the wings would have hit them or something. You would think it would have pushed them like forward towards the Pentagon.
Well, I don't know about that. The poles that were hit that I saw were each one of them. The 2 that I saw were each in 2 pieces.
Oh, like they were split in half or whatever?
No, they were cut off.
Cut off?
I remember seeing them when we got, when the med unit dropped us off near the triage area, which is the overpass or underpass underneath Washington Boulevard, where Columbia Pike comes down the hill. We checked in there with the EMS people, I guess that's who they were, and I got with Dennis and Skip, and I said, "I want to go over and see our guys, let them know we're okay." So the 3 of us walked back over there, and I guess that was probably the first time I saw the light poles. And they were, like I say, they were in 2 different places. The next time, and then we walked back, and so I would have probably seen them again. The next time I see them is, we're doing an interview with Dateline, which never got shown. They were supposed to show it on the night of the 12th of October, and that was the night they came out with the anthrax stuff, and they have not shown it. That was the first interview that I did, and it was like 4.5 hours of filming. Well, anyway, we filmed like about three hours up at the firehouse at Fort Myer, and then we get with our public, 2 of the ladies from public affairs, and then the producer who was from Alexandria, that's like Virginia there, and then the sound guy and the video guy. We all loaded up in 2 or 3 different vehicles, and we drove down to the Citgo station. And when we're down there, we are met with another public affairs guy who was in the armed forces. I'm sure he was in the Army. And he escorted us, all of us, over from the Citgo station over to as far over as they would let us go. Now, when we're over there, they had a flat. There was a flatbed trailer there, and everybody climbs up in the trailer, and they wanted to get a different, just a flatbed tractor trailer. I guess they wanted to get a different view with the cameras and everything overlooking the crash site. But this is when I remember the public affairs guy who met us down at the Pentagon, down at the crash site. He says, "We see the light poles there." And apparently somebody had picked up the one, which was also in 2 pieces, and carried it up, and they've thrown the one on top of the other one that was also cut in half. And I remember the guy making a comment. He says, "This is not where they were originally." And then I remember the camera guy, of course we weren't in the flatbed trailer then, but the camera guy is kneeling over top of this light pole, and the camera is about 3 feet long, and he's got the end of the camera, the lens of the camera, about, I don't know, a foot away from the light pole. And when he's doing that, I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, let's see, this pole here is about 12 feet long, the last 3 feet of it are smashed, and then the other piece of it was laying there. And like I say, all 4 pieces of the 2 light poles were in a pile there on the side of the freeway, on the Pentagon side of the freeway. And one of the poles had the other one was did not have the square base, and the pole was round. I remember looking at that and thinking, that's about as big as a volleyball. That big, around like 9 or 10 inches in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, the one pole was, I said, about 12 feet long. The last 3 feet of it were smashed. And but there's could have very easily have been more than I just remember seeing. I remember seeing two poles for sure. Mm-hmm. And then later on in some of our photos that we have, there's some of the aerial photos, you can see the light pole that some people have picked up and dropped off of the freeway over the, just right there where it came across the road, and dropped it over on the back side of the guardrail to get it out of the road.
Mm-hmm. What about like plane debris? Did you see a lot of plane debris after it
hit? Yeah, I mean, that whole area from in front of the fire station, you could not, I suppose that's what it was from. Part of it was parts of the building, I'm sure. I didn't see anything early on that you would identify that there was a plane there. It was just nothing but burning trash. It was just everywhere. You could not walk in that area, no matter which direction you pointed your foot, and not step on something. I remember seeing window blinds out in the field there on fire that were blown out of the window. I do remember later on, a little bit later, before we left the fire ground, I remember seeing three firefighters carrying what I assumed to be part of the airplane. It was about the size of a hood of a car, or a trunk lid of a car. But I want to tell you this as well. I don't remember if I saw it in a video, or I actually saw it, Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
But then some of the DOD photos that we get later on, you see a very large piece of what appears to be something from the airplane.
Yeah, like you could see a piece of the fuselage. It looks like you could see the colors, and then there's like a guy carrying a piece, and then there's another, like there's a few little pieces here and there.
Yeah, but like I say, there was no, I mean, the boys that came down on the first engine from Fort Myer, you know, so many of them said, where's the airplane? And I said, it's disintegrated. Somebody else would say, where's the airplane? And I said, it's in the building. And somebody else would say, where's the airplane? And I would say, you're standing on it. There was nothing outside the building, like an engine or a tire, or that I saw early on, that you would know that there was an airplane crasher. If Skipper and I hadn't seen it, if we would have been, like I've said many times, if we would have been half a second, we'll say, or maybe 1 second later, in our truck from the back right corner of the fire truck to the front of the truck, we would not have seen the airplane. There would have just been an explosion there, and for a long time, or at least we wouldn't have known exactly what happened. We might have assumed that since there were two other airplanes that had already crashed in New York City, that probably what happened here was an airplane. But that's just the way it went.
And what about, like, the hole? Like, there was, before the roof collapsed, there was just, like, a hole in the building, eh?
Yeah, it was, I don't know, there was a lot of damage to the side of the building. I mean, it wasn't a real defined round hole at that point, I don't think. I just remember, the first time I saw it is after I left Skipper out in the field, and I ran back to the burning fire truck. That's when I noticed, I mean, everything in front of me was on fire. The grass was burning, the blacktop was on fire, and all this debris was just everywhere. And as I'm running back and forth like O.J. Simpson, trying to get away from the cops, I guess. I knew if I stepped on something that wasn't firm, that I was going to likely fall and get and be injured by this debris that completely littered the field. I mean, material was blown clear across Washington Boulevard over into Arlington Cemetery as well, and that would have been about 200 yards distance away.
Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of people seem to think, like, the plane debris is, like, actually those cable spools that are in front of the hole.
Yeah, that doesn't have anything to do with the airplane.
Yeah.
There was a construction site there, Jeff. There was actually, it was actually fenced in by a chain link fence, and there was a couple construction trailers, office trailers, where the superintendents would hang out and stuff like that. There was an enormous project. Of working there. We were, I'm trying to think what wedge we were. But anyway, there was an enormous project there. I remember there was a big steel crate. It would be like a thing underneath a hot air balloon.
Mm-hmm.
The basket, it was like that, but it was steel, and it had either oxygen cylinders for welding and or acetylene cylinders. And I remember looking over there and seeing those things, and every one of them, it looked like a candle, and every one of them had been heated to the point where the automatic relief valve, the safety disc in the compressed gas valve, would have failed because of overpressure, and it would release the product inside, whether it was oxygen or acetylene. And every one of them was like 8 or 10 of them were on fire. Matter of fact, I think we've either got photos of that, or we've got video of it as well.
Yeah, that's where all like the black smoke's coming from.
Black smoke is coming from a tractor trailer that was parked there, which had a huge generator in it. And what the black smoke is from is the 500 gallon diesel tank. That was on fire and burning. That generated, it generated so much smoke that's going up in the sky between us and the sun that if you walked out away from it and got out to where, away from the black cloud of smoke, the sun was shining on you. I mean, and I'm sure you've read about the weather that day, the sky was the bluest blue you have ever seen. It just, there wasn't a contrail in it, it wasn't a scratch, it wasn't a cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And so in one moment the sky is incredibly beautiful, and in the next moment you think you're about ready to have a thunderstorm because it's black underneath, because the sun wasn't shining down in that area. And I remember that very well.
Yeah, because that's what Mr. DeFino was saying. He was like, that's where all the black smoke was coming from, was that diesel, that tank or whatever what you just said.
Yeah.
And so you never, like when you went inside the Pentagon, could you see wreckage or anything? Or?
No, I couldn't see anything. I'm in there banging around. The first fire extinguisher, I had pretty much expelled it. It was a carbon dioxide bottle. I had two of them, and I had a lantern underneath my left arm. And this is all after we were finished with manhandling the people out of the windows there that I mentioned earlier. So I kicked that bottle underneath the fire truck and pulled the pin on the other bottle, the safety pin, on the fire extinguisher, and put that lantern in my left hand and went around the back of the fire truck and went in the building. I don't think I went in the building any further than 30 feet, and I would see what I thought was fire. The hose of the fire extinguisher is fastened to the side of the fire extinguisher. You've seen this many times when you look at a fire extinguisher.
Mm-hmm.
What I would see, what I thought was fire, I would, with my right foot, I would lift the bottom of the fire extinguisher, not lift it, but swing it forward, and so that the hose is not pointing straight down, now it's pointing over toward the fire, and I would pull the trigger, or the discharge handle on the fire extinguisher, and then the agent would come out, and when you discharge these things, it has a loud noise. And when I'm, about the second time I guess I've done this, I hear a woman yell. She yells, "Hey," and it startled me, and I yelled, never occurred to me there's anybody in there, you know, and I yelled, "Hey," and one of us says, "I can't see you." I don't remember if it was her or me, and I am exhausted, and so then after one of us yells, "Hey," then she claps her hands very loud twice, and when I began to think about this later on, maybe that evening, I visualized the woman as wearing an Air Force uniform. I couldn't see my hand in front of my face, Jeff, so there's no way that, and she wasn't wearing an Air Force uniform, she was a civilian.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, she was able to stumble around and make her way, and while this is all going on, I'm thinking, I know I can get out of the building, but I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to get down on the floor and see if I can't find a better place to breathe, because I knew I could get out of the building. And so I've talked to her since then and explained to her exactly what I did and what I heard and what I remember her saying. And the first time I spoke with her, I said, "Well, how did you get out of the building?" And she goes into the fire extinguisher thing, and I says, "Yeah, that was me." but how did you get out of the building? And she said, well, I started working my way over that way where I saw this cloud, the swirling cloud. And the next thing I see is this, she described it as a big envelope, like a white a business envelope,
mm-hmm.
ending up on its end. And she said, and that was the door. I said, so you walked out behind a burning fire truck? And she said, yeah. And so that's how she got out of the building. So, and she did that while I was down on the floor. You know, for the longest time, I used to think, if I would have been smart, I would have taken the garden hose into the, which was right there on the corner of the fire station, which would be on the other, on the far side of the fire truck, just 30 feet or so away from the fire truck. I could have put out a lot more fire with it. But if I had to hit her in the face with that spray of water, she would probably have never known I was there, and she was that close to the exit. Might have been a different outcome. Who knows?
Yeah, well, I guess it worked out for the best. Well, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Matter of fact, I've got a talk to give down in southern Ohio here Tuesday. And it seems like I've done a lot of them lately.
Oh, yeah?
Kiwanis and Rotary and things like that. When they find out you don't charge anything, they call you, I guess. You know?
I guess, yeah.
That help you?
What about, do you know anything about a National Reconnaissance Office document that said that they were going to be doing an exercise that morning where they were going to have a smoke generator to simulate fire there at like 9:30?
Oh, when you first started mentioning that, to answer your question, what I thought you were going to ask me about was the Air Force, the North American Air Defense Command people and the Northeast Air Defense Sector, well, at least the Northeast Air Defense Sector, which is in Rome, New York, had an exercise planned that morning. I don't know if it was underway or not, but this is documented in the books, and this Air Force Colonel Robert Marr is notified of the attacks in New York City. And probably be through the FAA or somebody like that. And he wants to, he says this in the videos. He says, "Is this an exercise or is this for real?"
Yeah.
He says, "This is for real." But that's the only thing that I knew of that was, and I found that out only through the videos that we have.
Yeah, there was a whole bunch of simulated airplane hijackings going on that day.
I don't know what the exercise was about. It was just, but it did involve the Northeast Air Defense Sector,
mm-hmm.
in Rome, New York.
Like, have you looked at any? Like, do you know about all the conspiracy theories about 9/11?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember some guy was. We were doing something somewhere, and a guy said, "Are you aware that it wasn't an airplane that struck the building? It was a rocket or a
missile."
Missile or something. And I looked at him and I said, is that right? It would look like an airplane to me, and I left it.
Well, yeah, I guess it's hard to argue with somebody that's seen it with their own eyes.
Yeah, well, you know, I think probably several times, at least once, and probably several times. But I've had people say, but they didn't find any wreckage of the airplane. I thought, what are you talking about? We had 6 40-yard dumpsters full of it. You know, it was all over the place.
Oh, you had a whole bunch of dumpsters full of airplane parts?
Yeah, that was all that stuff was recovered.
But you never saw any wreckage? Right?
I didn't see any of that stuff. Most of that stuff was taken out of the building. The left main landing gear, as a matter of fact, actually traveled probably as far into the building as anything did. The airplane, the damage that the airplane does to the rings, the outside ring would be the E ring, and the inner five rings later would be the A ring. The airplane goes all the way through the E ring, through the D ring, and blows a hole in the inside, in the far side of the C ring.
Yeah, that perfectly round punch out hole, like I see.
Yeah. Now, when people first saw this, they thought, well, hell, this is the nose of the airplane is just inside this hole. Well, one of the interviews I did, one of the National Geographic interviews, I think it was the first one, there was this guy from England, Philip He was from England, and he said he was actually sitting in on the 9/11 commission things when he talked to me about this. And I said, "Oh yeah, the left main landing gear knocked that hole in the wall." And the guy says, "No, it didn't." And before that, everyone was saying it was the nose. Well, anybody that has any knowledge about the structure of the airplane and the size of the building should recognize that the nose of the airplane was probably obliterated by the time the airplane had gone 20 feet into the building.
Yeah.
And but Philip Warren tells me, he says, "No, that hole was generated as a result of the force being projected ahead of it." And matter of fact, that's in one of the, you can quote me on that if you want. But that's been, he mentioned that on the phone when he was still in New York City. And then later on we talked about it. I mentioned the left main landing gear, which was found in that area, but it did not have, it did not put that round hole in the end of, in the far side of the C-ring.
Well, did you ever hear about how a lot of these professional pilots analyze the black box data, and it doesn't correspond with the official story or the flight path or anything like that of the airplane?
The only thing I know about the flight data recorder, the voice recorder, was of no value. The FBI, Department of Transportation, and the FAA put together a program, and it was shown at least twice at the Hoover building, the FBI building. This is not a video. It looked like a video, but it was computer-generated, which you probably know all about that. It started, it was either 117 minutes or an hour and 17 minutes in duration. I want to say it was real time, and there was very little voice communication. I mean, they even gave us a sheet of paper. I got to see it at least the second time it was. I didn't see it the first time it was shown because I was actually out of the country. I had retired. I had another job.
Mm-hmm.
But so the thing starts out, and you're trying to visualize what you're looking at, and it looks like a series of telephone poles sticking up in the air. And but what you're actually looking at is as though it was there was a camera in the tail, in the top of the tail of the airplane, and it was always looking down and forward with the airplane in relationship to the airplane. So as the airplane departed, these vertical telephone poles are in a line, and as they go away from you, they get higher, and then the airplane makes a left-hand turn, and then you could see those poles continue to go up in the air. So that just showed that the airplane, I guess, was traveling. When the airplane got up and flying, the airplane never, what appeared to be the airplane, never turned left or right. Everything underneath it turned. Okay, I mean, it's like you were actually sitting on the tail of the airplane looking down at it.
Yeah.
The plane made a right-hand turn, or a left-hand turn. The ground underneath it rotated to the right or left, and that's the way it was. And then they had people there that could answer any, in my opinion, answer any question about the airplane that you could imagine. They had flight controllers, they had engineers, they had FBI people there. And at one point, one of the people who was on the stage made a comment. He says, "At this point now, we believe that the hijackers have taken control of the airplane." So then the airplane flies a little bit, and then it begins to make a left turn, and it pretty much makes a 180-degree turn and starts following its smoke back toward the Washington, D.C. area.
Yeah, it did like a big loop around it. Like it could have went straight and hit the Pentagon like in any other part, but it did that big loop around, and then it came down and hit, I guess. People say, like, that that's almost impossible for a person to do, especially a guy that wasn't able to even fly a Cessna.
Well, I don't know about that, but he was able to drive that airplane right through the first floor windows of the building. People said, "Oh yeah, it hit the ground and cartwheeled across the field." It did not. There was no, I mean, the windows above the hole were, well, the windows were gone, but the structure that supported those windows, like the actual building, they were intact until the building began to fail about 30 minutes later. But the airplane went right through the first floor windows. And one of the other, one of the engineers, I couldn't argue with him, but I don't see how it could have happened. They are saying that before the airplane hit the building, that it banked to the left, or the left wing went down, the right wing went up, do that because it's very maneuverable. It's not very fly-worthy, but it's very maneuverable. Whereas a large frame aircraft like a 757 or a 747, something like that, is not very maneuverable, but it's very stable. It's very stable. And I don't think that from the time we saw the airplane that it would have had that in the distance it was going to travel, which was no more than 200 yards, that it would have been able to do that and going at that speed. And we know how fast it was going about 10 seconds before the plane hit the building. It was going 462 knots. This information comes off of the flight data recorder that I remember seeing when we saw this so-called program or video, Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
So many times people would say, how fast is it going? I thought, I don't know. Well, how fast do you think it was going? Well, I'd have no idea. Well, how fast do you think it was going? Well, it's going fast enough to stay flying. We find out that as the airplane comes into the Washington area, the metropolitan area, it's going to make almost a complete 360-degree circle. At this point, when the airplane goes into a 45-degree right-hand turn and begins to make a right-hand turn and descend, at that point, the dials that were up there on the screen, which was like a compass, attitude,
yeah,
altitude, and speed. I think the top one was the speed, but it showed that the airplane was 6,200 feet in the air at that point. And it begins to, it's over a mile high in the air. So the airplane makes this right-hand turn and comes back around. And like I say, if you had a map of Arlington there that showed the Pentagon, you'll see where Washington Boulevard is pretty much running in almost in a north direction. When the airplane, the circle was probably something like an 8 or 10 mile diameter circle. And when the airplane comes back around and comes over and is approaching Columbia Pike, which is a straight road, coming through Arlington right up to almost within a couple hundred yards of, about a quarter of a mile away from the Pentagon, Columbia Pike makes a sharp left-hand turn, goes down the hill past the Navy Annex, makes a right-hand turn, and goes underneath Washington Boulevard. So I think what the pilot did is when the plane came back around and Columbia Pike is in front of him, when he gets lined up with Columbia Pike, Then here comes the airplane. It's coming straight ahead. So when Columbia Pike would make that left-hand turn and go on down the hill, the airplane just kept right on going straight, and then approached Washington Boulevard, crossed it, and went right across the field and into the building. But if you convert this speed thing from 462 knots to miles, it comes out to, my number was 520, and the 9/11 Commission book says it's 530. We couldn't argue with that.
Yeah.
But that was one of the things I wanted to know, is how fast was the plane going? Somebody made a comment about it once, and then once the plane hits the building, the thing stops. All the gauges stopped, everything stayed up there, and you could look at it. And I don't know how long it stayed on there, but then people began, and a lot of people asked questions. Somebody who knew something about the airplane and the flight data recorder and the voice recorder made a comment. You might want to check this out with somebody that knows something about these pieces of equipment. But the guy says, what you need to understand is, not so much that the plane was going 462 knots when it hit the building or when our recording stopped. He said there's about a 10-second delay on this thing before this information is put on the recorder. I don't understand how or why. So if that's the case, and the recording that we see actually stops 10 seconds before the airplane hits the building, then the airplane is obviously, and since it was accelerating, and there's something else I'll mention which I haven't mentioned yet, the airplane was going faster than 530 miles an hour when it hit the building, maybe 550 or possibly 600. But anyway, when the airplane comes out of this turn and he's lined up with, we'll say Columbia Pike, there were two vertical bars. They looked like a World Trade Center towers, actually. They were parallel. They stuck straight up in the air. what these things were up there for was to show the position of the flight. When these things moved, the first time is when the airplane took off, you saw them move clear to the top, both of them, two black bars. The next time that you see this happen is when the airplane is lined up with Columbia Pike, and then these bars go back up to the top. That means he had his foot to the floor. And you can quote me on that. And where I got this information, again, was from that program that was put on and shown there at the Hoover FBI building. And that was about January or February of 2002.
Oh, yeah?
Matter of fact, I had... I probably ought to spend a little time, see if I can't find those girls' names and their phone numbers that I talked to. I told them I was going to be out of the country when they were going to show this thing, like in November or December. So then when I came, I called them and they said we're going to show it in February or whenever it is. And so I made arrangements to go over there. It's the only time I've ever been in a Hoover building. Everywhere you went, there was somebody. You went to the bathroom, there was a guy standing at the bathroom. You know, they didn't want you wandering around in the place, I guess.
Oh, yeah, I guess not. You were saying about, like, how Boeings are, like, they can't really maneuver as good as military jets. I remember one of the ATC controllers, when he was looking at it, he thought he was watching a military plane because of what it was doing.
I don't know.
But, yeah.
Well, a lot of people saw the airplane. I would not suggest you think about it however you want, but there were people on the freeway that saw the airplane.
Yeah, well, like I said...
The Navy Annex that saw the thing go by. And I remember there was some artillery army guy retired or something, and he's saying there's no way that an airplane would make that a hole like that in the side of the building.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, man, I think that's pretty ridiculous. To me, it was a pretty ridiculous statement to make.
Well, it's kind of hard to, like, because you've seen it yourself, like, so it's kind of hard, you know, to believe any of these other theories.
Yeah, I agree.
But, like, I've heard everything from there was no plane to a missile to it flew over the Pentagon to people were saying, like, there was some C-130 plane flying behind it or above it or something.
There was a C-130 plane. This is definitely in the ABC, the national ABC video that we did. It was one of the ones that I did. And there was a C-130 that was coming out of Andrews, and it was on its way to, I can't remember. But anyway, somebody called, maybe it was Reagan Tower or somebody like that there, and said that, do you see this airplane? And the guy, and in the video, the guy who's sitting in the co-pilot seat, he's got his hands up in the air, and he's got his hands held at a 45-degree angle. And he says, you can see the airplane in a 45-degree bank. And then the next thing we saw, he said, was the smoke. The plane had hit the building.
Oh, so he saw it banking from the C-130?
C-130, yeah.
Mm. Wow. That's interesting. So, I asked you, you heard about all the conspiracy theories and stuff, like, do you believe everything about, like, we were told the whole truth about 9/11?
Well, all I can tell you is it's like Vietnam, you know. If somebody asked me about Vietnam, I'd feel comfortable telling them what I did when I was there. Other than that, I just don't know. So, when I tell these stories, Jeff, it's my experience. I don't condemn anybody. I'm sorry that it happened. I just tell, you know, people want to know what happened, and that's my account. Before, years ago, I became very interested in the Kennedy assassination. You started reading some of the stories about the, especially the people who worked in the cutting room, the morgue at Bethesda. And they asked these guys, supposedly these guys were there when all this stuff was going on, but yet when they're interviewed about this, they all seem to have some kind of a different story. Now, how can that be? Well, the psychologist will give you a reason for it, I guess. But I thought to myself, man, if I am ever in a situation where something like this happens, something of this national importance or significance that I'm involved in, I would definitely write down everything I could think of. And that night, probably about 11 o'clock at night, when we were back at the firehouse, I grabbed a legal pad and I started writing everything. everything down that I could think of. And over a period of probably 2 years, somebody would say something and we'd talk about this, we'd talk about that, and I'd go get a scrap of paper out of the trash or an empty envelope, and I would write this information down, and I had an x-ray, it was a big, I call it an x-ray folder, I think it was. It was a big manila, great big manila envelope, big as a computer screen, and I started stuffing these pieces of paper in there. I had, I don't know, 200 or 300 scraps of paper in it. It was about 4 inches thick. And so when I began to write this story down, this is what I wrote the story from, not hearsay, things that I had remembered and things that I had thought about. So there, we find out later on by the time we get some of this stuff written down that it was more time or less time elapsed, or this was not the first engine, or this was not the first company, or that arrived, or you know, things like that that would be not really that significant. And so pretty much the story is written on my personal account of what the three of us did that morning. That's the way I like to leave that.
Well, I thank you very much for your time, sir. I really appreciate you talking to me, and you helped clear a lot of things up.
Yeah, well, like I say, what I told you, there was no exaggeration in it. When I tell this story, like what I'm going to do Tuesday night, the last thing that I'll tell these people, the last thing I tell them is answering a lot of their questions. But the last thing I say as far as what the three of us did is I want you to understand that what we did was nothing that doesn't get done every day involving law enforcement, EMS people, and the fire service. It happens every day throughout this country. What we did, I didn't. Skipper or Dennis or I would not consider anything that we did heroic. We did what we were supposed to. We worked together as a crew. We functioned as a team, and we did it under very difficult situations. And I feel very special to be a part of those three guys.
I'm sure to everybody else out there, you guys are heroes, and I'm sure everybody appreciates what you guys do, and thank you very much for doing what you do.
Yeah.
You have yourself a good day.
Do the same, Jeff. Hope this helps. Take care, man. Good luck.
Okay, bye-bye.